fruit of discipleship. And I'm going to give a brief sketch of 11 Old Testament disciples. And I think before we're through, we will see in these the pattern of what the fruit of discipleship is. But just in case we miss it as we go through, or these verses don't bring it out, I will tell you at the end of these what it is. Oh, yeah, this. Okay. I think I'll be fairly close to the subject. I heard a preacher say once that he had three rules when he spoke. First thing that he did was took a text. The next thing that he did was departed from it. And the third thing was that he never got back to it. Now, these 11 Old Testament disciples, I don't think would meet the Navigator profile, and maybe not the New Testament profile, but they were used in a very great way. I think one of the things that we discussed that was of great interest in the recent planning conference was a subject that Walter and Scott presented to us on the matter of the dynamic equivalent. So he explained what it was, and I think maybe you understand it. I'm not real sure. But in considering how indigenous a work is in a country, we have Western standards. So if people meet certain Western standards, then we feel they've reached a certain profile. Now the dynamic equivalent would be the same qualities, the same result in those lives, even though it isn't exactly Western. For example, we believe that God's going to use us to make disciples among the illiterate people. So they can't finish our Bible studies, but they can have the dynamic equivalent. Well, we were so wrapped up in the subject that during one of the coffee breaks, one of the men went around and touched several people on the waist and told him he thought that was the dynamic equivalent of about 100 miles jogging, or somebody else, a little less, maybe somebody else 50 or 60 or 75. So these Old Testament disciples may not meet the New Testament profile or the Navigator profile, but they have the dynamic equivalent of those two profiles. Now, the first thing we want to do is take a quick look at the world as God has seen it in the past and as he sees it today. I take issue with the printing at the lower I found the switch. Floor switch here, huh? Well, you notice over in the left-hand corner, it says millions of years. So, according to this chart, from the beginning of time until the time of Christ, which is where the end of the era represents, the earth had become populated with 250 million people, only a quarter of a billion at the time of Christ. But I've started the chart, I've revised it, infringed on the copyright perhaps, and I want to start the graph with Noah. Over in Genesis chapter 10 and verse 11, we have a statement which I can accept on its face value. After listing the 16 sons of Noah, the scripture says, These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. Similar statements are made about the other two sons of Noah. It's interesting that in Luke chapter 3, as we have the genealogy of Christ, we can count 66 generations from Adam to Christ. If each of these generations was 40 years in length, then we go back, I shouldn't say from Christ to Adam, Christ back to Noah. There are 75 generations that go all the way back to Adam. We would come out with 2,450 years. So, if we believe that's about right, then we're going to start the world population, start repopulating the earth with Noah. And then by the time of Christ, 250 million. So you see, by the time we get to Abraham, the population was somewhere between 2 million and 5 million. I've tried to make this estimate several ways, and there's no way to get it accurate, but I think it's someplace in that vicinity, which we would conclude the population of the earth was perhaps about the same as the state of Colorado at the time of Abraham. The scripture points out that Noah lived for 350 years after the flood. Now, I'm not including him in the 11, but I think that he was the dynamic equivalent of a disciple. And what do you suppose he was doing during that 350 years? Well, he preached for 100 years before the flood, and he had a pretty good illustration of what happened to people that didn't repent, don't you think? Abraham was born only 2 years after Noah died. You realize that? So, I think God used the influence of Noah and one or two of his sons during that first period of history. God got a job done. Now it appears that at least one of them wasn't true to what Noah believed. We read in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 15, one which I'm sure that many have memorized, that shows that at least one of the three sons apparently carried his pre-flood beliefs over. So 14 and 15. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood. So all three of them didn't come through. One of them brought the gods from before the flood over. So what we're pointing out here is that God has had a different situation in different times in history. So Noah's influence, I think, prevailed among that first 2 to 5 million. And then God raised up Abraham, and we're not going to use him as one of the 11. Now, this is not going to take too long on the 11 because they come in 1, 2s, and 3s. So it'll add up pretty quick that way. But God repeated to Abraham that he had the whole world on his heart, as he talked to him in Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3. You remember that he said, as a result of what I want to do through you, that is, my motive is that all families of the earth may be blessed. And he repeated this to Isaac in chapter 26, 4, and to Jacob in 28, 14. Now, I don't know what the overlap was, but I like to think that the influence of Noah extended on beyond Abraham. Abraham had left the homeland, and then Abraham's heritage took up under the influence of Joseph. Do you think he had a pretty wide influence in getting done what God wanted done? I think that he did. But God didn't have such a big problem in these days because they were not that many people. But by 1700 BC, some 700 years, the population was now about 40 million. And so God had to use a little more far-reaching measures. So this is the first of our 11. And we see in Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 24, the first of our 11 dynamic equivalents of New Testament disciples. So God said to him in Deuteronomy 2:25, as he's repeating this, "This day will I begin to put the dread of thee and the fear of thee upon," see that next phrase, "the nations that are under the whole heaven." God was interested in the world. He chose Moses as the man to bear witness to all the nations of the world. That's what it says. Now Moses was well qualified to do what he had done. According to a book I read on Moses once, he attended the college, the University of On, O-N. And the curriculum in those days was a little different than it is today. In order to graduate from a university, the student had to complete all the courses that were taught. So among the things that Moses had to master to get his degree was all that was known about music, all that was known about medicine, all that was known about literature and poetry, all that was known about military science. He had to be familiar with all the languages that had been reduced to writing and could be reproduced, and to be well acquainted with all governmental science, how all governments had operated up to that time. So he's well qualified. I'm sure you've heard people summarize the life of Moses. He lived 120 years, and it's been said that he spent the first 40 years of his life learning to be somebody. And he had good education, brought up in the palace, the heir of the throne as the king of Egypt. Then he spent the next 40 years learning to be nobody. And then the fruitful part of his life, the last 40 years, he spent learning what God can do with somebody who realizes they're nobody. So his third 40 was the most fruitful. Now actually, Moses and Joshua go together in the same time period, so Joshua is number 2 of 11 we're going to introduce. He got the message from Moses and repeated it in Joshua chapter 4, verse 24. And we want to look at this common phrase that we had in Deuteronomy 2:25. He told them that God was going to do certain miracles. And he said, the reason he's going to, that all the people of the earth might know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that ye might fear the Lord your God forever. But he said, God's going to do certain things for Moses, the result of which all 40 million people are going to know about the one true and living God. Joshua told his people, God's going to do some things through us the result of which will be that all 40 million people are going to be reminded of who the true and living God is. We have a little more detail as to how this worked out as we look in Joshua chapter 6 and verse 27, where we're told, "So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was noised throughout all the country." And then in chapter 9 and verse 9, as the Gibeonites came to him, they said, you know, they were not telling the truth. They were really close by. They said, "We came from a long ways off, from a very far country. Thy servants are come because of the name of the Lord thy God. For we have heard the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt." I don't know what kind of a grapevine they had, but the word got around. They said, "We've heard about your God, and we've come to make peace before you even come to our country." Chapter 9, verse 24, "And they answered Joshua and said, Because it was certainly told thy servants, how that the Lord thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land, and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Therefore we were sore afraid of our lives because of you, and have done this thing." That's what God told Moses. "I'm going to put the fear of you on all nations." And the Gibeonites said, that's what he did. In chapter 10, verse 13, there was a five-nation confederacy came up against Joshua. And we have the account in Joshua 10 how that God commanded the relative motion to cease between the earth and the sun. And every nation which has a tradition has some kind of an account of the long day of Joshua. What God did there was felt around the world. Probably the most interesting of these traditions is from the Polynesians scattered throughout the Pacific. You know that one of the three largest islands in the Pacific is named Maui. Maui was one of the Polynesian heroes. And in their tradition, the queen, Maui's mother, was having a banquet for a visiting dignitary. And something went wrong in the preparations. And she was going to be embarrassed because the banquet wasn't going to be ready in time for her honored guest. So she called Maui, got a problem, do something about it. So he climbed to the highest mountain, made a snare for the sun, and trapped the sun as it came over the mountain. And in his struggle to get out of the net, the sun broke his legs off. And so he had to grow a new set. And while he was growing a new set, the banquet, which was scheduled for sunset, that is, preparations were complete, so everything went off without a hitch, and Maui proved that he was still worthy of his reputation. So God had different ways to let the people know that he was around and that he was in charge. Now the third of these dynamic equivalents is David. And actually we'll consider David and Solomon together. I'm sure that many of us have read many times. We're so familiar with it, we don't like to read what happened in 1 Samuel 17 as he faced Goliath. But he had a mission, and he knew it. And he said, verse 46, "This day will the Lord deliver thee into mine hand, and I will smite thee and take thine head from thee, and I will give the carcasses of the host of the Philistines this day unto the fowls of the air and the wild beasts of the earth." Now here's our phrase, "that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel." That's the reason God's going to come to my rescue. And somehow, the word's going to get to the 100 million people that are now on the earth at the time of David, that there is a true and living God, and he undertakes for his own. Well, what God did for David hasn't been restricted to that generation. I'm not much of a student of art and sculpture, but I've been amazed as I've visited some of the art museums of the world, the great preponderance of Bible scenes that the painters and the sculptors have used as a subject. And I believe, although I didn't make a calculation at the time I've seen them, that there are as many paintings and works of sculpture of David and Goliath as all the rest of them put together. So even today, what God did is continuing as a testimony. So I think that's three, isn't it, of the 11. We'll start getting in pairs now. Solomon, as you know, succeeded David. One of the things that he did was complete the temple. And on the day of dedication, as he was asking God for certain things to do, in 1 Kings 8:60, he said, "Now, once this temple is in operation, what my motivation is, verse 60, that all the people of the earth may know the Lord is God, and there is none else." Would you think that was enough of a challenge? God, now we got the temple. As a result of it, I pray, it'll be an instrument so that all the earth will know about the one true and living God. We go over to chapter 10 of 1 Kings. Talks about Solomon, verse 23. "So King Solomon exceeded all the kings of the earth for riches and for wisdom." How do you believe this? Verse 24. "And all the earth sought to Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart." The way we're supposed to evangelize today is to go out to the people. But in Solomon's day, God just says, "Sit right there, and I'll send all the world to you." One of the visitors that's best known from the biblical account is the Queen of Sheba. And she asked him a lot of questions. Some are in the Bible, and some aren't. I heard a preacher from Ethiopia that was speaking on this passage once. And, of course, they believe that the Queen of Sheba was their ancestor. And they had a whole list of questions that the Queen of Sheba asked and problems that she presented to Solomon. One of the tests that she gave him, according to this preacher, was she said, "Now I want you to take 10 young women, 10 young men of the approximate same age, height, weight, and so forth, and cover them over with sheets, and then mix them up out here. And Solomon, you're to stand back 10 feet away and tell me which are the young men, which are the young women." So Solomon asked his servant to bring 20 basins of water and 20 towels. And then he had the 20 people to wash their hands. And then he went out, picked out the 10 dirty towels, and said, "Those are the men." Well, no matter what the test was, he succeeded. But I think we have to believe that the world got the message through David and Solomon. Now the next one we come to, we're getting on another couple of hundred years, was Hezekiah. And Hezekiah had a problem. This problem resulted from the fact that King Sennacherib, the conqueror, was invading various parts of the world. And he had never up to this point had a reverse. He'd been successful in every conquest he had undertaken. So he sent word to Hezekiah to surrender. No use standing up. Now Sennacherib had heard about the true and living God, but he wrote to Hezekiah, and he said, none of the gods of the other countries have withstood you. And he said in verse 10 of 2 Kings 19, thus speak to Hezekiah, king of Judah, saying, let not thy God in whom thou trustest deceive thee, saying, Jerusalem shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Behold, thou hast heard of what the kings of Assyria have done in all lands by destroying them. Have the gods of the nations delivered them? What can your king do against my might? So you know in verses 14 through 19, Hezekiah had a prayer meeting. And he got in front of the tabernacle, laid a letter in front of God there. And he said, now it's true that Sennacherib has conquered every nation that he's been up against. Verse 17, of a truth, Lord, the kings of Assyria have destroyed the nations in their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore, they have destroyed them. Now, therefore, O Lord, our God, I beseech thee, save thou us from his hand. Now get the phrase, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that thou art the Lord God, even thou only. He had a little bit of world vision, and he recognized he was in the midst of history in his generation. So Isaiah brought God's message back. He said, everything's all right. Well, when they sounded reveille the next morning, well, we might read verse 34, what God said, for I will defend this city to save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. So, according to verse 35, there were 185,000 that didn't respond at reveille the next morning. The angel came through, destroying angel, and killed 185,000 of the troops. The rest of them were demoralized. And secular history gives an account of the military conquests of Sennacherib, and mention something very mysterious happened to a large part of Sennacherib's army. So the word got around to the world of that day that there was the one true and living God. Now, by this time, the population of the earth was still growing, if our figures are anything like accurate. And since we've got Jeremiah up here, we better mention him. Probably haven't been able to memorize a verse today down here in all the recreation. But we don't want to finish today without one. So we'll memorize one together right now. Many people think that Jeremiah was a local prophet. But he had a vision beyond this. In Jeremiah 22:29, he said, O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Jeremiah 22:29. You want to say it with me? O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Jeremiah 22:29. Well, the population was getting so great at this point that God needed a stronger platform for his people. So he shifted the platform to the secular kings of the day. The first of the modern Babylonian kings was Nebuchadnezzar II. It was he who invaded Jerusalem, burned the city and the temple, and took some 40 or 50,000 captives back to his capital city of Babylon. Among those taken captive, and I'm not going to tell you anything new here tonight, but just maybe put it in a little bit different context. Among those taken captive were four teenagers. The king recognized that they had something to offer by way of cross-cultural input. So the opening of the book of Daniel tells us that he gave them a crash language and culture course. And at the end of the time of this three-year course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which were the new names that the king of Babylon gave them, and Daniel, were 10 times smarter than any of the other graduates of the class. Now, I don't know how you figure 10 times. I suppose that it is 10 times, isn't it? Verse in here, I think it's 10 times. Well, if the highest, then I guess that anybody else got was a grade of 10. So that was the ratio. They all made 100. Closest competitor was 10. He assigned them to his chief advisory council, those that were most important, to give him wisdom. Well, Nebuchadnezzar hadn't been in office too long until he decided to strengthen his hand. You remember, we read about this in Daniel chapter 3. He put up a big statue and commanded all these people on his staff to worship the image. Now, I think Nebuchadnezzar might have had a little bit of reservation about doing this because he had had an encounter with Daniel, who had revealed a secret. And after that, we read in Daniel 2:47, the king answered and said unto Daniel, "Of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldest reveal the secret." So he had already acknowledged the one true and living God. But he went through with this scheme anyway, to build a statue and command everybody to worship the statue. Now you know the story real well, how that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused. And he gave them a second chance, and they made the flames a lot higher this time. And the king gathered his chief people around him, showed them how powerful he was. Then he looked in, and he said, "We threw three in, and I see four. And the fourth is like the Son of God." And instead of being burned, Nebuchadnezzar found out they'd composed a song. Well, you didn't know they composed a song that we've got a record of, did they? We looked in there and saw there were four, and they were singing this song. It's cool. It's cool. In the furnace. Words didn't come out very clear, did it? But that's what it was. It's cool. It's cool. It's cool. Now, after it was over, turning to Daniel 3:29, Nebuchadnezzar called his secretary and said, "I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall have their houses burned down." Then Nebuchadnezzar had an experience. And in verse 37 of chapter 4, he summarized it and says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the God of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those who walk in pride he is able to abase." Then he put out another decree, and we want to see the extent of it. Chapter 4, verse 1. "Nebuchadnezzar the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, how mightier his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation." So for the first time in history, the ruler of the world, political ruler of the world, put out a decree giving his testimony to all the 125 or so million people who were now on the earth. Within the next 140 years, this was repeated two times. After serving in the Babylonian courts for some 70 years, a new regime, the Medo-Persian, took over. And even though Daniel was almost 90 years old, the new Persian king took him on as an advisor and counselor. In fact, he did even more than that. By the way, secular history doesn't know about Darius the Mede. But most careful researchers say he's the same person as General Gobryas of history, who conquered the Babylonian Empire and became the governor and the ruler of the ex-Babylonian Empire, while Cyrus was the real ruler behind the scenes, but he didn't even come to Babylon for 4 months after the conquest. So we see after he had set up the empire, chapter 6 and verse 1, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first. So here Daniel, the visitor in the court, became the man next to the king. Now you know the story, how the two other presidents were jealous because they couldn't steal anything. So they thought up this plot to do away with Daniel. He was thrown in the lion's den. King Darius had a bad night. He dismissed the orchestra. But Daniel had had a powerful effect on him. And he seemed to have committed this whole thing to God. He realized he'd been tricked. So verse 19 of 6 says, "The king arose very early in the morning and went in haste unto the den of lions." And here's what he said. "Daniel, is your God, whom you serve continually, able to deliver you from the lions?" Now he had quite a job as the head president of all this great empire. But the king says, "I've observed that you serve your God continually." Well, King Darius had more faith than anybody. And so out Daniel came. Then this very remarkable decree followed, verse 25 through 27. "Then King Darius wrote unto," get it, "all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men tremble in fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God." This is a command, not a suggestion or testimony, a command that every subject in his kingdom worship the one true and living God. Within about 30 years after Daniel. Xerxes the First was the ruler of the great Medo-Persian Empire. As a result of the influence of Daniel and some of the predecessors, there were some God-fearing Jews in the palace. One of these was a man by the name of Mordecai. And you remember the circumstances through which his cousin, Esther, became the queen of all the world. Then there was a plot to exterminate all the Jews. This was very serious because someplace out in the empire were the ancestors of Christ. Well, you remember that the king had made a decree that on a certain day, every Jew was to be slaughtered. In order for a king to retain his credibility, he had to act like he was God. And that was, he could never reverse anything that he ever said. So the decree, according to his legal staff, was irreversible. But you remember how Esther got in the act. And as a result, he told Esther and Mordecai, you come up with a decree that will save the slaughter of the Jews, but still keep me from losing face. So they did. And this decree said that on the day of the execution, every Jew is commanded to defend himself, and every officer of the empire is to help them. So who's going to do the dirty work? Who's going to do the slaughtering if every official in the empire is to defend them? Now, what was the reaction throughout the world as these things happened? I think the majority of the empire population were not happy that all the Jews were going to be wiped out. And then 4 months later comes a countermanding decree saying they're to defend themselves. Well, the reaction throughout the empire was, aha, the king made a mistake. He is human after all. Who's running things back there anyway? And the word got out. Mordecai is the real power behind the throne. He's the one that approves the decrees. But the great point we don't want to miss is in Esther chapter 8, verse 17. And in every province and in every city, whithersoever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and a good day. And if I could add a word in here, which I think is what the word is saying, although it doesn't mention it. And many of the people of the land turned to the God of the Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. This may well have been the greatest revival in history up to this point, as throughout the whole world, as a result of this change of things, which they knew the one true and living God had brought about, there was a great ingathering of people of all races and nations into the family of God. Now I think I've covered all 11 of these Old Testament disciples. By the way, I think we should note, although it doesn't fit in with this, that no wonder Xerxes permitted Nehemiah to go back and restore the city. This Xerxes was a stepson of Esther and had grown up under the influence of Esther and Mordecai. No wonder he was sympathetic. Well, all these 11 Old Testament disciples had something in common. What is the fruit of discipleship? It has to do with evangelism, with worldwide impact in evangelism. God's got a bigger problem, if we can put in those terms today, than he had then. But in every generation, he knew how to evangelize the world, see that it was reached. But there's far more people today than there's ever been. The next doubling of the world's population will only take 15 years. And then it will double again in 11 years, according to this projection. Well, I understand that the messages so far have been changed to kind of emphasize the basics. So we've got one of them here, haven't we? God needs a lot of disciples to reach this huge population of today, which is growing so fast. Now, I think a study and discussion of heroes can often be more depressing than it is helpful. Now, we look at them and are discouraged instead of being encouraged. So the application we would make from this is in the book of Esther, a verse that it didn't read. Mordecai told his cousin Esther, the queen, "Who knows but what God brought you to this place for this particular challenge? Maybe you'll only have one great challenge in your whole life, but don't miss it." So among the things that I hope that we leave this conference with, as well as the other basics which have been reviewed, is a new desire to make sure that we are involved in the fruits of discipleship, the fruit of discipleship, which has to do with an impact on the world for Jesus Christ, making sure that in our own world, that what God wants to do through us to fulfill the Great Commission is accomplished.